cool. Yeah, so I'll just dive in. So I'm Nick Fortuno, and I'm a game designer in New York. I co-founded and chief creative officer a company called Playmatics in New York. I've done games for about 10 years. I've worked on a number of digital and non-digital games, and actually that's what I want to talk about today. When I was asked to speak here, I sort of like kind of posed a question to John about whether I've done transmedia work, but I've also done a lot of game work, and games as part of transmedia work is sort of like one of the buckets that things fall into. And we sort of described that it'd be more interesting for me to talk about games specifically. And I think the place where games are interesting is that games are about interactivity. And when I heard the questions in the room, it was really interesting to me because interactivity got folded into participatory, got folded into user-generated content, and it was this very quick jump of like interaction to user-generated content. But there are fields of interaction that have nothing to do with user-generated content that I think are equally compelling and engaging, and that gets back to the point that was raised about engagement in the first place, like the idea of what it means to create an experience that's engaging to someone. And I think that games are interesting towards that question, not just because games can do that, but because games are the field of sort of design and aesthetics that have been studying interaction since their inception. Because if you look at Go, or you look at chess, or you look at like a Mesoamerican ball game, none of those things exist in their properties, their material properties. None of them exist in their stories. They exist in their engagement and their play. So if I put a chessboard in front of you or a Go set in front of you, I didn't give you Go as an experience. I just gave you the pieces of Go. Go doesn't become Go until you play it, right? And so games have a way of understanding interactivity that I think is deeper than many other forms, just because we've been doing it for thousands of years. Now, I'm not going to talk about Diner Dash, although you can look up Diner Dash if you're interested. And I'll talk about it later if you want to know more about Diner Dash. What I want to talk about today are games that are, I think, more closely related to nonfiction. And I think the closest parallel we find is in a field called serious games, which is another terrible name. But and I actually think it's actually completely erroneous and drags people in the wrong direction when they think about it. But serious games are games that are, the definition of it is games that are designed to produce fun specifically, although they have to be games, I would argue. But they're also designed to put forward a political argument, an educational topic, or generally like a persuasive position. People who study this, by the way, I should say up front, do not typically differentiate when they take this seriously between games that promote advertising messages or political messages or educational messages. It's not, if a game is aiming to persuade, it typically does it the same way no matter how it does it. And that the non-fictional element of that persuasion is more of a constraint on the game design than it is a constraint on the rhetorical methodology that we use. But it points to some interesting ramifications that I think are important. Now, the important thing to think about when you think about interactivity, and I think this is like kind of the key thing to think about when you think about interactivity, is that interactivity itself is a aesthetic technique that you're using. It's not a component of something else that's an aesthetic technique. It's not like I'm watching a movie that happens to have interactivity in it, and so it's a movie aesthetically with some interactivity. If I have interactivity in the experience, the interactivity itself is an aesthetic experience. Like how I manipulate the controls of the system, how I make choices, like how I guide the story or whether the story is challenging to me, that itself is an aesthetic experience that has to be controlled for. And so if I'm making a piece of work that has an interactive component to it, the way I interact with the work is as important as the content of the work in determining the emotional resonance or the argument of the work. And so when games approach serious topics, we typically approach them through the medium that we are, which is play. And so what we ask users to do is to play with the serious content. That has a lot of ramifications and there's a lot of meanings to what I just said, and I mean all of them. but I'll just take a look at a couple of quick examples just to show them that this is work that Playmatics or I have done, although I can talk more fluently too about what work that other people have done. So the simplest way we do this is by just constructing a game activity that forces you to do what we want you to do. So this is a game that Playmatics has worked on recently called the History Detectives Lab, or HD Lab. We did it with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and Lion Television. History Detectives is a show on PBS, if you're unfamiliar. It's kind of an archaeology research show where they find an object in someone's house, and then they talk to that person about it, and then they research the history of the object, which uncovers interesting facts about history. And Corporation for Public Broadcasting was interested in teaching people about historical research, sort of like, if you had an object and you wanted to research its history, how would you do that? That's a methodology to teach middle school students about internet research and photographic research and how to interview people. And so what we built was an experience where you investigate an object. So you like mouse over parts of the object and you get information about them that you keep track of in your notebook. Or you go through a photo archive and you find images in the photo archive that have things that relate to the topic that you're looking at. In this case, the case that you're investigating is a clock that was found supposedly in a museum. And they were trying to find the history of the clock, and the clock is actually tied to a mill, a lumber mill in Oregon that had a fire. And so your investigation of the clock leads you to learn the history about lumber mills in Oregon and this particular fire that actually happened. And so you do that through the methodologies that someone would actually use in that historical research. In this case, you're looking through a photo archive. In this case, you're actually interviewing an expert. And what you're trying to do when interviewing the expert is investigate, well, what's, like, how relevant is what the expert just said to me to what I'm investigating? Or is this something that I want to eliminate? What kind of questions do I want to ask to drive this person to where I want to go? And the idea here basically is we're just going to gamify effectively what is an interview process, or gamify effectively what is an internet research process, so that we ask users to go through that process to they themselves learn what's going on. And that just leverages play, right? We give you points if you do well. We take points away from you if you do poorly. We make it slightly challenging so it's interesting. We evoke all the things that games typically do, but we put them in a context that forces you to do that through this educational process. Now, that's, I think, a very direct way of doing this in terms of, like, literally we took the activity and then made it into a play activity. But I think there's a broader and more narrative way to do it that could be equally interesting. And for that, I'm going to talk about a game I made a long time ago, but I think is, like, a significant game in the field, which is called IET, The Cost of Life. IET was developed in partnership with Microsoft and an organization in New York called Global Kids, which is a youth leadership organization. And the idea behind IET is that we wanted to make a game that explored issues of education and poverty. The students were in charge of the content, and they wanted to talk about Haiti, so we talked about Haiti, IET being the Creole word for Haiti. And so in the game, you're basically asked to help get the Guillard family, who are these people you see around the screen, as educated as possible during the four years of the game's duration. But you can see that there's like a number of different strategies to the game that we ask up front that point to the conditions under which these things are examined. By the way, I'm very deliberately not showing video of these games. I could just show you video of the play, but I think that would defeat the whole point of what I'm talking about. So you can find IET online. You can just Google that word and you'll find it. And you can play it yourself. And I'm happy to talk about other games that you can look at if you're interested in this in more detail. So in IET, there's a balance, because in Haiti there's a balance, between your economic status and the education you can get. And what we found when we worked with kids of the age group that this game was targeting, largely middle school students, even in impoverished conditions in the U.S., what you find is an expectation among children that children go to school while parents work, and that's the relationship that you know, exists. And that's how school exists. So if you were going, so they just imagine in every country in the world, what happens is the kids go to school and the parents work, and that's not true in Haiti at all. In Haiti, because of the kinds of jobs that parents can get, and because of the economic conditions and the infrastructural conditions of the country, it's often necessary for kids to drop out of school very early and then work to help support the family, to keep the standard of living high enough, because the jobs that parents could work on their own that would potentially support the family are often so dangerous that they would get sick or injured doing them, and so it requires the entire family to work. And so the point behind this game was to demonstrate that to students. And we did that by basically putting them in charge of the family and having assigned them to roles during the course of a year. So every season you would get to assign them to a different kind of thing. So you could assign them to work, or you could assign people to go to school, or you could work on the family farm, or if people got sick, you could send them to the hospital for a season. And by doing this, you had a chance to actually try to play the family as they tried to become educated, but also as you tried to keep them alive. And if you could keep their cost of living low enough, or their standard of living high enough, you could keep them healthy as they developed all of these things, but putting people in school itself drew them away from work, and that therefore got you less money and made it harder for you to keep everybody alive. And so what we asked you to do basically was, well, try to run this family getting as much education as possible. And what people typically did was they put the kids in school and they put the parents in work, and their money slowly bled down until someone got very sick or injured, and then everybody got very sick, and then someone in the family died. And so when they lost, they were forced to sort of face the fact that system didn't work, and they'd have to go back and try again to figure it out. And what they ended up doing was replicating the kinds of conditions you saw in Haiti, where the oldest child would get a little bit of schooling and then quickly get shuffled to work, and then the other kids would shuffle in and out of school based on what was possible or not possible, and you had them making choices that are the choices of poverty, that the choices that you're forced to make in impoverished environments. And that's the core idea behind the game. So what we do with IET, The Cost of Life, is by, you know, providing this sort of narrative example of, you know, these people working and the conditions that they go through, which are slightly randomized, right? So, you know, Marie has a good day in the market because there's lots of people there today. But like, as you go through that, you start to have to make choices about what's going on, and those choices reflect the choices that families in these kinds of conditions have to make, and you end up replicating that. Now, I think what that can do is it allows you access to the same kind of content that you might show in a linear narrative format, you know, by just following a family around and like seeing the kind of choices that they're forced to make, but you get to do it by letting the player actually do it themselves. And you get to do it through a process of discovery where the player doesn't quite know what to do at first, but then by fumbling around in the system, they can come to some kind of conclusions of their own and then end up replicating the system that you're talking about. We designed IET with experts in Haitian economy and Haitian education. So we try as much as possible to cause the system to emulate the kinds of decisions that would actually happen. Of course, it's not perfectly accurate because no simulation is, and we defaulted to things that were slightly more difficult because it made the game more challenging. This game is actually quite hard. At least that's what everybody tells me when they play it for the first time. But what we got, I think, really powerfully was the idea that poverty, the conditions of poverty were not easily escapable through methods that Western audiences knew, and it gave a better appreciation to students of exactly what was going on when, you know, families made the decisions they made in these kind of environments. I think the potential for things like this is huge, and I think that there have been more of them more recently, and I can talk about more of those examples individually later on. What they demonstrate is the idea that what the interaction does is it provides a vehicle for decision making and exploration in a system that's different than what a linear form can do. And so when you're thinking about like what the possibilities for a game are, you have to think about what games do naturally. Like, they motivate people through challenges, they motivate people to achieve goals, they allow people to explore systems and experiment with systems and sort of try things out, and then they can find optimal strategies in those systems that then become reliable and reinforceable. And those kind of methodologies are things that I think advocacy can use quite powerfully, and I think has IET being, I think, one example of those. Of course, you're not limited to digital kinds of events, and we've done this kind of work in the real world as well. This was a game that Playmatics worked on with Jane McGonigal in the New York Public Library called Find the Future, in which they were trying to, the New York Public Library was interested in getting people more access to the reference library, the main reference library on 42nd Street, and so we built a game where you were asked to kind of spend the night at the library and wander around looking at different kinds of objects and scanning QR codes near those objects to learn about their history. And it basically was an exercise in both showing people like the riches that the library had, but also giving them a chance to actually walk through the steps of the library. So you have to go to a research section and do research on a magazine, or you have to wander into the part of the library you've never been before and talk to a librarian. And by doing that, you just got yourself familiar with how to wander around the library and what the library was. So if you were ever to come back, you would actually be able to do that. We did this. This itself was kind of a transmedial project in the sense that we had an iPhone application that you could use, an iPhone and Android application that you could use to scan QR codes and register objects. And additional information would come up on the code. So if you scan the Declaration of Independence, you would get more information about the Declaration of Independence. And then the game invited you to submit your own like writing or your own pictures or your own thoughts on the effect that those objects had, which eventually became a book that the library kept. This is a much more event-based kind of activity in the sense that, you know, it involved 500 people in a single place overnight. And I think this is another way that games can be used for outreach into these kind of occasions, because the games are very good at creating spectacle and teamwork just naturally, and, you know, just hang around any bar next Sunday if you want proof of that. That's basically all I have to say. I mean, I there's other material I could show, but given I have 30 seconds, I'll just sum up. What I want to suggest to you is that, like, when you think about interaction as part of a transmedial strategy, what you want to think about is what interaction does well. Interaction motivates behavior and lets people play. And you shouldn't be scared of that play. You should embrace that play. And you should think about the way that your topic can be played with the way these topics tend to be played with, so that you can give people a vehicle that's another access point to your material, that's not simply necessarily viewing it or getting facts, which I think is valuable, but also experimenting with themselves and coming to their own conclusions.